Punjabi Hari. Punjabi Hari. Jaya Radha Madhava. Punjabi Hari. Punjabi Hari. Gopi Jana Balabha Girivada Dadi. Yasoda Nandana Braja Jana Randana. Yasoda Nandana Braja Jana Randana. Yamuna Tira Vanachadi. Jamuna Tira Vanachadi. Jaya Radha Madhava Punjabi Hari. Jaya Radha Madhava Punjabi Hari. Jayom Vishnupad Parabahamsa. Mad His Divine Grace, Sri Bhaktivedanta Swami, Sri Prabhupada Ki, Ananta Koti Vaishnavrinda Ki, Granta Raj Srimad Bhagavatam Ki, Gopimanandhi. Om Namo Bhagavate Vasudevaya. Om Namo Bhagavate Vasudevaya. Om Namo Bhagavate Vasudevaya. Text 32 is written on the board, so we'll chant together. Tata cha vyadatu sarvam yataha madhusudanaha vachayitva svachyanam tad dravyena giri dvijan tata cha vyadatu sarvam yataha madhusudanaha vachayitva svasyanam tad dravyena giri dvijan. Tata cha vyadatu sarvam yataha madhusudanaha vachayitva svasyanam tad dravyena giri dvijan. Tacha vyadatu sarvam yataha madhusudanaha vachayitva svasyanam tadravyena giri dvijan. Tata cha vyadatu sarvam yataha madhusudanaha
Vachayitva svasyanam tadravyena giri twijan yatacha vyadatu sarvam yataha madusodhanaha vachayitva svasyanam tadravyena giri dvijan yatatta thus cha and vyadado they executed sarvam everything yatta as aha he spoke madhusudanaha Lord Krishna, vacha yitva, making the brahmanas recite, swasti ayanam, the auspicious chants, tat dravyena, with the paraphernalia intended for Indra's sacrifice, giddi, to the hill, dvijan, and the brahmanas. So that's the word for word. I'm going to go back because we ended with text 30, so we'll read text 31 translation and then 32-33. Shukadeva Goswami said, Lord Krishna, who is himself powerful time, desired to destroy the false pride of Lord Indra. When Nanda and the other senior men of Vrindavan heard Sri Krishna's statement, they accepted his words as proper. And there's a little commentary. Which I'd like to read. Commentary says, Bhagavan, addressed as Kalatma, which means the force of destruction, indicates that Krishna, Bhagavan, would destroy the sacrifice of Indra. Hearing the words of the Lord, Kalatma, who desired to destroy the pride of Indra, Nanda and the cowherd men accepted his proposal. Oops. And that was Vishwanath Chakravarti Thakur's commentary. And now here's Jiva Goswami's commentary. But it's taking a little while to load. Okay. Krishna, who sets time in motion, upon whom every one is dependent, spoke. Because everyone is dependent on him, they accepted his words. Because he is so powerful, he made Indra's pride insignificant. When sacrifice for Indra is performed, it's taking a while to load, sorry. Krishna sets that sacrifice in motion, and now he stopped it. By his desire, everything happens. Who can oppose his desire? Krishna, who has a black body, spoke. He controls everyone by his beauty. What to speak of using his words? Krishna, whose nature is to attract the whole world, spoke. Thus it is not surprising that they accepted his words. Though Indra was worshipped, his pride was most disrespectable, since he saw, Indra, saw the cowherds as material and saw Krishna as a material being in relation to them. And he quotes the next chapter, chapter 25, text 3, where Indra says, "Just see how these cowherd men living in the forest have become so greatly intoxicated with their prosperity, seeing them as material. They have surrendered to an ordinary human being, Krishna, and thus they have offended the gods." So that's Indra's take on what just happened. So Krishna wanted to check that pride of Indra, so he did what he did. And so, let's see here. Here's the purport, translation and purport for the verse that we just chanted, 32. "The cowherd community then did all that Madhusudana had suggested. They arranged for the brahmanas to recite the auspicious Vedic mantras, and using the paraphernalia that had been intended for Indra's sacrifice, they presented offerings to Govardhan Hill and the brahmanas with reverential respect. They also gave grass to the cows. Then, placing the cows, bulls, and calves in front of them, they circumambulated Govardhan." Purport. "The residents of Vrindavan were simply devoted to Lord Krishna. That was the sum and substance of their existence. Being the Lord's eternal associates, they were ultimately not concerned with Lord Indra or ritualistic sacrifice, and they were certainly not interested in the mechanistic philosophy that Krishna had just spoken to them. They simply loved Krishna, and out of intense affection, they did exactly what he had requested." Paragraph. "Their simple, loving mentality was not small-mindedness or ignorance, since they were devoted to the Supreme Absolute Truth, who contains within himself all existence. Thus, the residents of Vrindavan constantly experienced the highest essential truth underlying all other truths, and that is Sri Krishna himself, the cause of all causes, and that which sustains the existence of all that exists. The residents of Vrindavan were overwhelmed in loving service to that Supreme Absolute Truth. Therefore, they were the most fortunate, most intelligent, and most pragmatic of all living beings." And commentary by Vishwanath Chakravarti Thakur: "The cowherd men, made diligent by Krishna, Adrita, offered to the brahmanas and Govardhan the items meant for the worship of Indra. They offered grass to the cows. Putting the cows before them, they circumambulated Govardhan." Jiva Goswami's Toshini commentary. "Their actions are described." Harivamsa gives the details. And he quotes from Harivamsa: "Goloka was filled with great joy and shouts, generating bliss. Instruments blared and bulls and calves roared. The cow herds were joyful. There were lakes of yogurt, whirlpools of cream, and rivers of milk." Paragraph. "Krishna is called the killer of the demon named Madhu." That's how he's addressed in the verse. "To show his great ability and the cow herd's lack of fear of Indra. Krishna, like the bee enjoys sweet, like honey. Thus he started the sacrifice for his dear servant. And then consumed the offerings. They did exactly as Krishna said, but in these verses, the details are not mentioned. The commentators on the Bhagavatam encourage us to read the first 9 cantos before we read the 10th canto, because otherwise they won't understand the 10th canto, or say the same thing. There's so much nectar in the pastimes of the residents of Vrindavan. Let's go there to the nectar. We're nectar seekers. We want the sweet nectar of Krishna's pastimes. However, if one hasn't carefully, thoroughly understood the previous 9 cantos, one will the pleasure one experiences and the sweetness that one has a sense of will not be so transcendental, at least be mixed at best. This doesn't mean that the past, so just like Prabhupada made available Krishna book for different reasons, you know, when he would say over and over and over and over and over and over, don't go to the 10th canto, read the first 9 cantos, then he produced Krishna book. And, you know, there's a response from the devotee community, why is he doing this? And the explanation was he didn't know if he would get to complete the 10th canto, and so he wanted to make an understanding of the 10th canto available that the general public could enter into and not misunderstand. So he did Krishna book. And basically Krishna book is even, you know, the chapter numbers are following the chapters of the 10th canto. And that is to say, so it's a summary study of, which Prabhupada said, means I can do what I want. He made it, knowing where there would be misunderstandings, regularly he would elaborate and elucidate Krishna's position, because the first 9 cantos make it clear what Krishna's position is. We know from the two questions, Canto 1, Chapter 19, Shukadeva Goswami comes on the stage, and Maharishi Pariksit asks him two questions. Although we say Srimad Bhagavatam is narrated by Shukadeva Goswami, he doesn't even start speaking until Canto 2. And he appears at the end of Canto 1, and he's presented two questions by Maharishi Pariksit. What is that subject matter that should be heard, chanted, and always remembered? What is the duty of the person about to die? Those two questions. So in Canto 2, he begins to speak, and the first chapter of Canto 2 is the universal form. And then following universal form is the Paramatma feature, the Lord of the Heart. And then the third chapter, Canto 2, is devotional service, change of heart. There's a reason why Canto 2, Chapter 1, is universal form. And there's different ways of explaining why that comes initially, or why it's again making its appearance in Canto 3 and again making its appearance in Canto 5. And it has everything to do with understanding the world around us in relation to the personality of Godhead. Or in Sataputta's language, the way we view the universe has a profound effect on the way we view it ourselves. Nice, I'll say it again. the way we view the universe has a profound effect on how we view ourselves. And without self-realization, is it possible to understand Krishna without understanding our position within the space where we are? Is it possible to understand Krishna? Is it possible to understand 10th canto? So many subject matters are there in the preliminary canto so that this exchange makes more sense. You know, why Krishna spoke the way that he spoke and why the Brijvasis responded the way that they responded. The uniqueness of their love, of course, it can be spoken, and Krishna book speaks it, and these purports also speak it. But, what's the foundation for that? Are they, whatever, you know, the purport, the Bhaktivedanta purport here says, you know, they were in touch with the highest truth. Now, they weren't Vedantists. They weren't scholarly Prabhus. They weren't Brahmanas. They're village people. You know, of course, Nanda Maharaj was learned, and the elders had some degree of learning, but they're Vaishyas. They're not Brahmanas. And, you know, their life was dedicated to cow protection and production of grains. Krishi Goraksha Vanijam Vaisha Karma. So they performed that, we discussed this yesterday, that Varnashram function. They were true to their position. And as we know, Krishna, son of Nanda Maharaj, didn't go to school. He was deprived of kindergarten and elementary school and middle school. He was like a deprived little boy. So when Vasudeva and Devaki, being Kshatriyas, were reunited with Krishna, one of the very first things that they were anxious about was his education. Then there's all this detail of, you know, who would educate him. And the commentary says Krishna decided who would educate him. There's details. But Vaishya boys and Vaishya girls, they don't go to school. They follow their parents and the family occupation. That's, you know, traditional. Now, modern times is modern times, but that's traditional. But at the same time, they're in touch with the highest truth because of their attachment to Krishna, most exalted souls, attached to Krishna in a way that others are, they can't touch the attachment to Krishna that others have. Little example, Queen Kunti, she was attached to Krishna like anything, and she had knowledge like anything, but she couldn't understand the love of Mother Jasoda and the love that Krishna has for Mother Jasoda, or the queens had not a clue of the love that Krishna has for the gopis and the love that the gopis have for Krishna. So the super exalted position of the resident of Vrindavan was not an academic one, although when they spoke, you know, they had realization of truths that modern day scholarly people don't have a grasp of. So as we hear in the commentary, they weren't attached to rituals. They were doing, you know, they had the reason. Because Krishna asked them, why are you doing this? Well, it's our duty. We've received, we want to give back to Indra for what we've received. He's given us rain, and we're dependent upon the rain for the production of grains and taking care of the cows. And so we want to honor the person from whom we received our bounty. But But why would they do, we discussed this yesterday, why would they do rituals like that if they're so attached to Krishna? So they weren't doing because they'll get something. They were doing because it's just part of their culture and their high character. You receive something, you say thank you. And that's a way of saying thank you to Indra. But Krishna didn't like the pride of Indra, so Krishna did what Krishna did. And they felt safe doing what Krishna wanted, and they didn't have any other desire to do anything other than what Krishna wanted anyways. Because Krishna is their all in all. That this is the unique position of the resident of Vrindavan. So, just going back a little bit, I shared this, I think, yesterday, but I'll repeat. Just before leaving the country, I was in Los Angeles, and the section of the Bhagavatam that they're discussing presently in Los Angeles is Cantu Chapter 1, which is the universal form. So receiving a YouTube recording of Druta Karma's class after I left Los Angeles, and he gave his whole presentation on Vedic cosmology, saying essentially that fifth canto Bhagavatam is cosmology with scriptural references from the fifth canto and other places. The TOVP is producing Vedic cosmology in the temple of Vedic planetarium. The Virat Rup, the universal form. Fifth canto is a depiction of the universal form. And so having been prompted and perked my interest in Vedic cosmology and TOVP because, for many reasons, I've been spending some time hearing different explanations than the one I'm used to, that the one I'm used to is Sataputta's. And there's others that are a little different than Sataputta's. Even like Dhanavir Maharaj and his book on Vedic cosmology is a little different than Sataputta's. And then there's others without going into details. So it's a fascinating subject. And why is it important? Well, Prabhupada writes why it's important. It's to help us have a foundation of understanding the world around us. And, you know, interestingly, Canto 3 comes in between Canto 2 and Canto 5. And Canto 5 is the universal form. Canto 1, these 11 chapters are about the universal form with details and details that are mind-boggling. And then Canto 2, Chapter 1, has details of the universal form that are quite different than Canto 5. And then in between is the unfolding of the creation, which precedes Sankhya philosophy. It's part of Sankhya philosophy. How does the universe manifest? Because Brahma, in the middle parts of Canto 3, the question has been raised by Vidura to Maitreya, how did Vishnu do the creation? So the Vishnu creation and then the Brahma creation, sub-creation, Sarga-Visarga. And with the Visarga, there's the Virat Rupa. And there's the elements that make up the Virat Rupa and the positioning of the demigods in the Virat Rupa. And then so the universe, Brahma's work is being detailed. And so there's the elements and there's presiding deities of the elements and there's the demigods. It, you know, doesn't give the detail of how the demigods come from Brahma, but the demigods come from Brahma. And they still can't make the universe function. You know, everything is there, A to Z, because Brahma knows how to get A to Z, and he does it. But the universe isn't functioning. So then the demigods offer their prayers to Vishnu, help. So Vishnu enters the scene. And the demigods are dependent upon Vishnu. Even they have power, and there's Prakriti, and they're presiding over Prakriti, and you know the structure of the universe is there, but nothing's functioning. They're dependent upon Vishnu. That's the good news. We're dependent upon Vishnu. Brahma is dependent upon Vishnu. The demigods are dependent. The universal form is dependent upon Vishnu. The universal form is his form. And its functioning is dependent upon Vishnu in his spiritual feature of Vishnu. And then there's the universal form. And then behind Vishnu is Krishna. Everything is resting on Krishna. But, you know, anyway, to get to the 10th canto, it's not like an obstacle course to get to the 10th canto. It's foundational to help build the proper understanding of, you know, the five subject matters of Bhagavad Gita. Prakriti, time, karma, jiva, and Ishvara, and how they interact. And then here comes Krishna on stage with his pastimes. So all of that is in the background, and one has gone through it carefully and properly understood who we are, what material nature is, who Ishwara is, what karma is, what time is. At least, you know, reasonably, and that's Bhagavad Gita, and then we go through Bhagavatam, the same, certainly the same subject matters are there, but in expanded form. Then we have, you know, through the bhakti process, one has more of an opportunity, greater purification and thus qualification to understand, properly understand instead of misunderstand Krishna's pastimes. So our acharyas are giving us the, you know, the insider's look of Krishna's pastimes. He's enjoying, it's lila. He's enjoying at the same time he's stimulating their love for him through his pastimes. He's stimulating their love for him. And then over there is his devotee Indra, who's Krishna's making some arrangements to check the pride of Indra. There's a verse in Brahma's Prayers, Canto 10, Chapter 14. It connects with universal form, but Brahma says he's appreciating the resident of Vrindavan because there's where he is. He's with Krishna in Vrindavan. And the residents of Vrindavan have, because of their devotion, they also have senses like we have senses, but their senses are fully spiritualized. So their intelligence, their mind, their eyes, their ears, their senses are fully spiritualized. They're just receiving Krishna as he is without any misunderstanding of, like we have, forgetfulness of Krishna, and we hear a sound or smell a smell or taste a taste or see something. We don't see in relation to Krishna, but the resident of Vrindavan do. And so Brahma, in one of his prayers, is saying the senses of the residents of Vrindavan are like cups. And the cups are receiving contact with sense objects. So not just the ears like cups, but senses receiving sense information, you know, Gyanendriyas and Karmendriyas. We're conditioned souls. We have those. But those are not just like near this fleshy thing on the side of your head called an ear, the organ, or the eye, or the skin. Those are organs of sensation. But there's the power of sensation that are grouped about the mind. This is Bhagavad Gita. The senses that are grouped about the mind. Those senses grouped about the mind are not the organs, it's the power of seeing, the power of hearing, the power of smelling, the power of touch. And then there's the organ through which that power is acting. And if the organ is broken, then the sensation doesn't work. If the power is withdrawn, then the sensation doesn't work. So the demigods, the function of the demigods, going back to Canto 3, the function of the demigods is dependent upon Vishnu, and so when Vishnu empowers the demigods to do what demigods are supposed to do, then, you know, like, we can't even blink our eye, Prabhupada's statement, without sanction of the demigods. We can't see if without the demigods seeing. There's, you know, the power of seeing is invested by Surya, the sun god. The power of smell, each of the sense faculties, there's a presiding deity over those sense faculties, and the demigods receive their power to oversee sense faculties by Vishnu. And the statement in the third canto of Bhagavatam is, without Vishnu seeing, no one can see. Now, fortunately, he doesn't have a breakdown with his seeing faculty. But the power to see is through the demigods to the living entities, and then there's sense objects which we can perceive. But we can only perceive according to our level of consciousness. But if the level of consciousness is higher, higher and highest, then the demigods... This is now the 10th canto, chapter 14, explanation. The demigods cannot experience as the residents of Vrindavan experience because of the residents of Vrindavan have higher consciousness. They, demigods, cannot see Krishna and hear Krishna's, you know, their senses are not activated. Our senses are not activated like the senses of the residents of Vrindavan. And the demigods are not either. But the demigods, because vicariously, by overseeing the senses of all living entities, including the residents of Vrindavan, they can vicariously experience and appreciate what the residents of Vrindavan are experiencing. Something like that. So it doesn't make sense what Brahma says in Canto 10, Chapter 14. Doesn't make sense unless there's a careful reading of Cantos 2 and 3 and 5 and how the whole puzzle fits together. It just sounds like some eulogy, just a eulogy. Kind of like went over the top saying some eulogy to Krishna. But it's part of the function of the demigods and part of Brahma's function. Brahma is of the ten that are cited. Brahma is in charge of intelligence. Vishnu is in charge of consciousness. Supersoul is in charge of consciousness. The Ashvini Kumaras, they're in charge of sense perception, that is, you know, touch perception, and so forth. It's all very technical. It's like, what does this have to do with, do I have to know all this to go back to Godhead? We won't be able to, the short is, we won't be able to understand Krishna properly if we don't understand the structure of the universe properly. We don't understand, like, what's out there. Because we're contacting what's out there but we're experiencing with a lower consciousness. And as Kali Yuga progresses, it gets lower and lower and lower and lower. And modern education helps it go lower too, because it's just the phenomenal existence is all that exists. And there's denial even that there's a mind, or they're uncertain, at least. Is there such a thing as a mind that interacts with matter? It's a big deal in science and even philosophy. The proof is sense perception. And if you can't perceive it through your senses, where's the proof? There's this celebrated atheist professor from some university in England, I forget his name, and I saw a little video on his life because I was curious to see how he does what he does. And he was like in this angry mood. Where's the proof? Meaning, if there isn't something that's sensory data that proves, then I can't accept it. I can accept only that which sensory data can experience. There's verification. That's pramana, pratyaksha. And anuman, of course, they have interpreted the objects, the, you know, the sensory data. But, you know, is there a mind? Who's seen one? Where's the evidence? Etc., etc. So the modern paradigm that we have all been spoon-fed since we were little is science. You know, the empirical sensory experience, that's proof of something. And anything other than that is, you know, that's not proof, that's not evidence that something exists. You can infer it, that's interesting, but you can't prove it, because you can only prove through sensory experience. Then what to speak of, you know, the realm of spirit? Just a little sharing, and then we'll go right back to the purport and we'll end. Once upon a time, I was in high school, a few years ago. And in the school that I attended, there was a program called American Field Service. Does that exist here in Chicago, AFS? I'm asking you, when you went to school here in Chicago. American Field Service, AFS. Never heard it. Okay. Okay, when I was growing up, there was such a thing. So kids from our school went to some other country and did their senior year of high school study, and some person from some other country came to our school, like, you know, exchange students, foreign exchange students. So when I was a senior in high school, my parents had accepted, had made the application, they were accepted for being the host of an AFS student, and the student was from Japan, named Ken Ijiri, and he was a genius, and he was like really upset that education in America was so rinky-dink, so, you know, unchallenging. And then he graduated, and, you know, I didn't hear from him until some years later. I had become a devotee, and he was just completing his third PhD. His first PhD was in mathematics, second PhD was in physics, and his third PhD, which he did at the University of Michigan in Ann Arbor, was biochemistry. And so he was on his way back to Japan, having his third PhD in his hand, and he wanted to see the Empire State Building. No, he wanted to see the Statue of Liberty because he hadn't seen it. So he knew that I was in New York, so he got in touch with me and said, you know, can I visit? Can we get together again? And can you take me to the Statue of Liberty? I'd never been to the Statue of Liberty. I knew where it was. So he came, and we're in a subway car riding to Battery Park, the southern tip of Manhattan. And I asked, what was your third PhD on? And based on physics and math and biochemistry, it was, what happens when a frog cell divides from one to two? That was his PhD. You know, math and physics and biochemistry. So that was a very simple explanation. So I said, what if for something like that to happen, a soul has to enter so they can have two cells instead of one cell? I mean, I don't know if that's required, and I was just asking him subjectively, what if that was the case? He gave a very honest answer. He said, that's something scientists can't talk about because you can't study it. You can't verify it through empirical data. So it's a subject we can't even talk about or consider. I said, well, that's honest. Because I was expecting a slap in the face, you know, from a triple PhD. We never did go see the Statue of Liberty either. We got to the place and it was too long in between when the next boat was going, and so we just saw it from a distance and then went back. But, you know, there's an ethical scientist, but the principle of science is sensory experience only, because that's all. He didn't say that you can't have anything else that exists, but there's no evidence of something else existing because you can't perceive it through senses or extended senses. Now, there's inference, without going into the details of inferring out-of-body experiences and past life remembrances and so many things, but it's not proof. The proof is, where's the evidence? So how do we have proof that anything that comes from the 10th canto, that Krishna did what he did, and how do we know it's not a story? And we have some foundation of faith based upon, you know, the earlier cantos. You know, fortunately, if we've read the earlier cantos, that faith will have been nourished. There's some things that are just inexplicable, and that's quite okay. We're comfortable with inexplicable things because the foundation of faith, but not blind faith, having gone through the first nine cantos, then it makes, you know, certain things make sense, like Aham Sarvasya from Bhagavad Gita. There's a source of everything, and Krishna is that source of everything. And thus, knowing that Krishna is the source of everything, it may take me. So, by the empiric process, Bahunam Jamanam Ante Gyanavan Mahaprabhadyate Vasudev Sarvamiti Samaha. So, to come to that position, Bahu Janma. And here we are, who knows what our previous lifetimes have been, but we're in touch with the writings of our founder Acharya, because there are many other renderings of Bhagavad Gita that don't lead to Krishna. Although it's all about Krishna. Somehow we a good fortune, so here we are. And now we're reading 10th canto, chapter 14. Excuse me, 10th canto, chapter 20. 24. So what's our qualification to understand, you know, you know, the morning class here at the Chicago Temple has been through cantos 1 through 9. So there's foundation, at least over all that period of time. It's incumbent upon us to carefully read, hear, discuss, and understand the earlier cantos. It's not like there's no nectar there. It's the foundation for understanding the proper nectar of the loving dealings between the residents of Vrindavan and Krishna. When why is Krishna doing what he's doing? Why he's doing it in the way that he is doing it? Of course, it's his free will, but there are some indicators. He wants to confirm with the residents of Vrindavan that these principles of honoring the brahmanas and serving the cows and the process of sacrifice, the mantras, these are things to be honored. Govardhan Hill, above all, the best of his devotees in Vrindavan, according to the gopis, and it's spoken of here also. Krishna wants the residents of Vrindavan to feel those feelings and have to please him in those ways. So we get that understanding from the commentary, which we wouldn't understand without the commentary. We wouldn't understand Bhagavad Gita without the commentary, what to speak of Bhagavatam. So, any discussion?
Maharaj, I got confused.
You're confused?
Between phenomenal and non-phenomenal. And
between what and what?
Phenomenal.
Phenomenal.
And non-phenomenal.
Non-phenomenal.
Like
numinous.
Yes. Yeah. And there is Prabhupada explained in, he wrote in Parapat in first canto. So he said, for Mahatattva, he used one word, I forgot that in word, monumental something.
Say it slower. He uses the word?
Monumental something. He used one word. And he is telling, Prabhupada is telling, that two things are non-phenomenal. Like, I got confused, can you please clarify? That is like body, mind, intelligence, and false ego. Out of these three, so which two are non-phenomenal?
Okay. Different answers could be given to that question. You ready? The word numinous comes in Canto 9, I think it's... Oh, excuse me. Bhagavad Gita Chapter 9, I think it's Text 2. Phenomenal. And then the other word is Prabhupada's unique translation, numinous. But you read the purport, and numinous, he says specifically, is the soul. Another rendering of numinous, upon which the phenomenal can be, in that sense, it's everything that's created, the asat. And then there's sat. That's easy. Asat and sat. So phenomenal is asat, mind, intelligence, and false ego included. Not just, but another meaning of phenomenal is that which you can measure, like so many decibels, or, you know, what frequencies of light we can see and cannot see. So, like, etc., etc. Something that's measurable through our sense organs is phenomenal. Then there's a different explanation, or another explanation of numinous, and that's what's behind, the background behind that which is measurable. And it's not. That's, you know, if this one's right, then that's got to be wrong. Or if this one's right, then the other one's got to be wrong. They're just different usages of the term numinous. I forget what the Sanskrit is in that text. But let's just say the mind. We know we have one, but who has seen one? And how do you measure the mind, or say it differently? You know, same question differently. Where is the mind situated? You can say this and that. Some people say their head, some people say their heart, some people say different things. But it's subtle. And from the mind comes ideas, and from ideas comes organization of physical form. Like, you know, the devotees are sitting on a bench. So before there was, this is Bhagavatam, it's also Socrates, which says before there was a chair, there was the concept chair. Then I've studied this in college. And then where does this idea chair come from? That it infers, it's the mind saying there must be a realm of absolutes before the idea chair came, which was before there was a chair. So there's the phenomenal is the chair. The numinous in this explanation is where the phenomenal, what's in the background behind the phenomenal that you can't perceive and measure, but we know it exists. And then what's the basis or support of that? Like, you know, supernumous spirit. I don't know if I'm overcomplicating, you know, the answer to your question. Your question specifically is what is phenomenal? And my answer is there's at least two ways of saying what is phenomenal and what's behind the phenomenal. Spirit and ultimately Krishna, everything is resting on Krishna, Sat. Asat is resting on Sat. Within Krishna comes the phenomenal. And it's sometimes manifest, sometimes withdrawn. But it's still phenomenal. And one could say the idea before we assemble, you know, stuff to make it look like, you know, a building, or make it look like a street, or make it look like a, you know, something, an automobile or cell phone, or, you know, there's intelligence and there's mind, there's subtle phenomena at work. Another way of saying the same thing is that's not phenomenal because you can't measure it. Am I confusing or helping? Huh? A little bit confused. So it depends on the nomenclature. The short of it is, there's different ways of answering your question depending upon the definition of phenomenal. One definition of, say it again, short. Sat and asat. Asat is phenomenal. Sat is numinous. There's another meaning of the word phenomenal, that which you can measure, that which you can perceive with your instruments of perception, the Gyanendriyas. But you can't, with your Gyanendriyas, perceive the mind or intelligence or false ego. Therefore, the separate, yet another explanation of phenomenal is, you know, that numinous is what's behind the phenomenal, what's behind the measurable, perceivable experience of the Gyanendriyas. That's the mind intelligence. You know, you follow this distinction? That's one explanation. And there is another explanation. That's one explanation. It's not wrong, it's right. There's another explanation that's different, that it's also not wrong, it's right. It's semantics. It's definitions of things. The literal explanation in 9.2 Bhagavad Gita is what you said. Mind intelligence and false ego is part of the phenomenal realm. There is another explanation. And let's say this. Going back to the universal form. Do you understand? We discussed this yesterday in class. Do you understand? Can you claim? The answer is no. Can you claim to understand the universal form? No. It's mysterious, isn't it? And I was saying in yesterday's class and today's class, Vedic cosmology is the universal form. The first thing that Shukadeva Goswami speaks about is the universal form. Because we need to understand the universal form before we can understand the Paramatma feature and the Bhagavan feature. And how much do we understand the universal form? Not much. It's mysterious. Now we know that Krishna is in the, non-physical realm, non-perceivable, phenomenal realm. His body is not material. His body is all spiritual. It's beyond our experience, but we accept that. Now what's this universal form thing? And it's a gateway to understanding Krishna. That's Canto 2, Chapter 1. We can skip it and go right to the 10th canto. But that's not what Vyasadeva has done. And then Canto 3 and Canto 5. And so, what is it? It's not easy to understand. Mountains that are 80,000 yojanas tall, times 8, or 10,000 yojanas tall, trees that are 10,000 yojanas tall on top of mountains. Huh. So what is it? It's what is it? How to understand these things. If we can't understand these things, are we going to properly understand Krishna, who is very clearly in this realm of not phenomenal? So what is it? It's the structure of the universe. Here's a very simple explanation. According to levels of consciousness, these are people that teach about Vedic cosmology. According to levels of consciousness, you can experience this level of phenomenal. And you have a higher level of consciousness and you can experience another phenomenal and then another level of consciousness and another phenomenal. Within this universal form picture. And it's not differentiating. If you're at this level of consciousness, this is what you'll experience. If you're at that level, it doesn't make the differentiation. Now, back to your question. Mind, intelligence, and false ego, are they part of the phenomenal or are they part of the numinous? That's your question. And a short answer is they're part of the phenomenal. And there's another explanation that has to do with understanding the universal form. And it's, empiric description. Yeah. Mind.
Regarding mind, mind is considered as a sixth senses.
Yeah.
According to Bhagavad Gita.
Yes.
So can we consider that mind is not phenomenal?
Okay, let's do this. And that the sixth sense, A or B? And the answer is B. A, the senses means this thing, the ear, the organ, these two things, the eyeballs and these sockets, my skin, the sense of touch, and smelling and taste. That's A. That's what the senses mean. Or B, the senses mean the subtle capacity to see, smell, taste connects with the sense, and then you can see, smell, taste. They're subtle, like the mind is subtle. And the power of the mind and the power of the senses of perception, not the organs, but the senses, the sense of perception, that's subtle. And that's the six senses grouped around the mind. So now, back to your question. Is subtle phenomenal or numinous? And there's two ways of looking at it. You know, I just could have really given a simple answer and say, yeah, mind, intelligence, and false ego, it's phenomenal. What else? But there is another way of perceiving or regarding that which is behind the perceivable, measurable experience of a living entity. And that some regard that as numinous. What's behind the perceivable? Because without that explanation, the reason I'm giving this is because I've been pondering over it a bunch in the past 2 weeks. That is, you know, Vedic cosmology. You know, the temple of Vedic planetarium is coming up real soon. And, you know, are we supposed to understand it or just go, wow, that's far out? How does it... We're distributing sets of Bhagavatams, and hopefully some people are reading them. And when they come to this stuff, and they ask us, we go, well, you know, I just distribute the book. I don't know what it says. So why is it there in the book? If we just, like, flip through that section and go to the next section. Why is it there? What is phenomenal, and you know, the empiric scientist that says we can only know what our senses perceive, and that which our senses cannot perceive, we cannot know, or it just doesn't exist. And then when there's some evidence that shows that there's something else that exists, this one's working just fine. Sorry to disturb your mind with not giving a straightforward, simple answer. Anyone else here?
Phenomenal and non-phenomenal depends upon your degree of realization.
No, I didn't say that. We don't experience what the demigods experience. A microbe doesn't experience what we experience. We don't experience what a demigod experiences. The demigods don't experience what Tapaloka, Janaloka, and Maharloka residents experience because of levels of consciousness. And by levels of consciousness, one can have senses grouped around the mind that can experience things that you and I can't experience. And as Kali Yuga degrades consciousness further and further, our capacity, one's capacity, will be also diminished. So elevation of consciousness permits a capacity of the mind to grow, and because one of the primary functions of mind is to take sense perception and make some order out of it. That's a mind function. But we can't place order out of lots of things. We're bewildered by the illusory energy, and Maya is working. So you have something?
Yeah. Guru Maharaj, could you shed some light on, more light on what happened to Indra?
What happens what?
To Indra.
What happens to ignorance?
To Indra.
Oh, what happens to Indra?
Because he was part of the original troop that went to Shirodakshai Vishnu requesting, please descend, there's a lot of demoniac kings on the planet. And then Krishna came. In fact, the Lord asked some of the demigods, you take birth in Vraja and I will come. In fact, every once in a while...
Didn't say Vraja, I'll take birth on earth. And you come to assist me.
And Shukadeva Goswami every once in a while mentions that the cowherd boys, or some of them anyway, are the demigods.
There's detail. They're partial expansions of. That is to say, when Krishna's pastimes are over, those partial expansions return back to their position. It's not like there's a vacancy. The sign outside says, I've taken a vacation to go take part in Krishna's pastimes. I'll be back when the pastimes are over. It's a partial expansion of, and those partial expansions return by Krishna's arrangement. And then the Nitya Siddha devotees, their identities, it's a little mysterious, but their identities, they're eternally existing in Braja, and their forms don't manifest that way. Exactly what happens when Krishna, it's Jiva Goswami describes, when Dantavakra is killed, Shishupal, and then Dantavakra, it's a detail, but there's a place just outside of Mathura that's named after him. Krishna decides to go to Vraja. He enters Vraja in Vraja dress, not his Kshatriya dress, and spends time with the residents of Vrindavan and arranges for those partial expansions to go back to their demigod position. It's really something. I was going to say, it's something like, the Yadu dynasty being annihilated. But then the eternal associates of Krishna, the pastimes have closed. And shortly thereafter is when Krishna departs and the whole thing. So it's just making an arrangement so they return. So now your question specific to Indra is, was Indra unaware of who Krishna was? Because Krishna said, I'm going to appear on earth and take care of Kamsa.
And was he also one who expanded himself to take part of Krishna's pastimes?
That detail I don't know. But whether he did or not, whether he did or not, he can become bewildered because he's not perfected soul. He's an elevated devotee who's not perfected, and non-perfected souls can become bewildered. He became bewildered. Seeing is ordinary. I mean, the verse is quoted, chapter 25, text 2. That's what material consciousness means, seeing that was as spiritual as material. So he saw the residence of Vrindavan and Krishna as material. That's an offense. And that's covered by Maya. So he was covered by Maya. And Krishna wanted that covering to be removed, so Krishna arranged. So your question specifically is, didn't he already know? Because he was told, and didn't he appear? And all, so didn't he already, how could he not know? Seems to be that's your question.
Yeah, it's like major forgetfulness.
Well, forgetfulness, sure. And Krishna just helping him get free from that forgetfulness. And forgetfulness has something to do with pride. When pride enters the heart, one becomes forgetful. It's right in the word that Shukadeva Goswami is using to describe Krishna. Yeah. Kalatmana. Kalatmana. Kala, the force of time, that which destroys. He's acting as the destroyer of the pride of Indra. That's an aspect of Krishna because time is under him. He's acting as a force of to destroy the pride of Indra. Because Indra's dear to him, and Indra got covered by Maya, so he wants to end pride. Any other question? Okay. See the Prabhupada key?